Well, as we talked about right before the break, Chicago's violence prevention community got a big boost today from an unlikely source, the NFL. The NFL came through and handed out a couple of grants as part of their Inspire Change initiative. This includes over 500 grants awarded to current and former NFL players who are working for not-profits for across the country. And in Chicago, that means the Community Partnering for Peace got a piece of that money to work on nonviolent issues and violence prevention, but also to work on a community police academy. In studio tonight to talk about that is Vaughn Bryan. He is a former NFL player who is the executive producer or executive director over at the Community Partnering for Peace, and he's in studio with us now. Vaughn, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So, first of all, just this idea, where the NFL is getting into the business of obviously giving grants and trying to help different communities that where they serve. How did you get involved with this, and what does it mean to get a grant like this?
How we got involved is I'm fortunate to, in you know, my career, as I spent about 4.5 years working for the National Football League. So the woman who is the senior vice president for social responsibility is a former colleague, and a woman she works closely with. Claire Graff was in our PR department and was assigned to mm-hmm. our department. So we did a lot of good work together back when I worked in the NFL from 2005 to 2009. So, you know, understanding what they do now and what I do now, mm-hmm. you know, it was obviously some synergy there. And we, you know, had some conversations, sent them some information about what we're doing. And, you know, we were lucky enough to get selected.
And I want to get into the nitty gritty of what you guys are doing. I've been kind of focusing on one part of it, mm-hmm. and that's this idea of a community police academy. And this is, I think this grabs people's attention because there's a lot of buzz and controversy around what a police academy is or what it should be. Mm-hmm. What's a community police academy?
So the idea is that for new and transferring police officers that are coming to a particular police district, we know we're a city of neighborhoods, and so police districts have, you know, they're a part of a neighborhood. And we want community members to be able to welcome police officers to their community and show it to them from their perspective. And we think that type of orientation and engagement early on can have an impact on police community relations, because I think the way, you know, police are trained, they're looking at problems and pretty much problems only. And from my own experience working in Chicago Public Schools and building the Safe Passage program, you do get jaded, like getting shooting notifications every day or going mm-hmm. to a, you know, a neighborhood and thinking about, you know, how do I make it safer, what the problems are. You know, you're looking at it really from a negative perspective. But when you live in a community, you know it from a much broader perspective. Now, clearly, you know, citizens don't necessarily always feel safe, but they also know what the jewels are. They know who the people are. They know where you should go to eat. They know who the influencers are. And you need to get that perspective. And I think we need to humanize our police officers. Mm-hmm. We need to get to know them on a personal level so that we understand that, you know, they go home at night and they, you know, want to be with their families. And, you know, I can relate to that because, you know, I do this work, and I feel like I'm, you know, to a certain extent, a bridge builder, because my father was a police officer. And, you know, I was telling people that, you know, I was a professional athlete at a point in my life, but before high school, every coach I had was a police officer. And so the relationship I had with the police was very positive, given it was in my house. You know, I was a high-level athlete, and they set the foundation for that for me. And so all of my friends... there's an assistant coach, for example, that works for the Bulls now, Sean Respert. He's an all-time leading scorer at Michigan State. We played Police Athletic League basketball together. And so, you know, like there's professional athletes, both football and basketball, who were coached by, you know, Detroit police officers. And, you know, so my experience is colored by that. And so I understand the community. I understand the police. And I want to bridge that gap.
Where do we get it wrong? Because, you know, the media plays a role in this, too, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. we will just almost shade or tell a story where it's the community versus the police. Mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. there needs to be, police need to do better with community, or community needs to step up to help police. Where do we get it wrong, since you've lived both sides?
I think that, you know, you can't really take it outside of the context of, you know, Chicago and its history. And, you know, there's a history of organized crime here. There's a history of gangs. There's a history of housing discrimination. Yeah, you know, so everything sort of that impacts how we police our community. So so to say how did you get it wrong? You know, from, you know, some early days of, you know, the inception of our country. So I think that that's
we can go all the way back.
Yeah, you know, because it does create systems and structures that, you know, can be oppressive to certain groups of people just, you know, by some of the political decisions.
You talk about violence prevention and I want to get to some of the things that are happening in 2020, and we have seen some positive stories come out. The numbers in 2019 were trending downward. We just had a great story this week already that said Chicago had its first day of no homicides, which usually comes a lot later into a year. So it seems like things are working. For your case, it seems like what you guys are doing with violence prevention seems to be building a violence prevention infrastructure. Yes. What does that mean? What does it mean to build an infrastructure around nonviolence and violence prevention?
Yeah, so basically, I think the way they thought about the work in early days of this community outreach, violence interruption type of stuff is we need to mediate conflicts. We need to, you know, create ceasefires between groups and just make sure that nobody is being shot or being killed. And so I think as we've gone on, we realize that people's lives have to move forward. So once the mediation happens and there's, you know, conflict, okay, well, what are we going to do with you? Like, do you have an education? Do you need mental health services? Do you have a place to live? Do you have access to a job? Do you have any skills that can actually move you in a particular direction so that you don't actually come back to a conflict? So, you know, those things have to happen. So when we're building infrastructure to do that community outreach work where we build relationships with those people who are vulnerable to gun violence in some of our most vulnerable communities and neighborhoods. And then we're offering them services. What are the things you need to move your life forward so that you can live an empowered life where you are economically healthy, psychologically healthy, and that you can, you know, live a healthy life and create a sound environment for your family?
And when you talk about these vulnerable communities, you really have really specifically dialed in on 22 of them in Chicago. When you talk about that, it almost feels like we have to rethink the way that as society we approach some vulnerable communities, because you talk about services and people may be listening saying, well, why we have to spend money on every single person to give them every single service. But there seems to be a need to rewrite the way that we even think about how communities are brought up.
Absolutely, because I mean, there's been disinvestment, and again, we live in a capitalistic society. We can't take away from that. So you know, population growth and trends and markets are part of the mix. And so when you lose 200,000 black people between 2000 and 2010, that is one of the things that explains why the schools are closing, because the people don't live there. And so you have school buildings that are half empty. How do you maintain that economically? Because basically your education market has dried up. And so those type of things mean that you may not be getting the best education. And if you don't get the best education and you are 30 years old and you're beyond high school, what institution is really looking out for what has been created here? Now, I don't look at that and think somebody was deliberately trying to oppress this 30-year-old person.
Or take away the individual responsibility of that person.
Exactly. Right. But I want to be able to go reach out to that person who probably did fall through the cracks and maybe had some traumas, whether they saw violence in their homes or in their communities or whatever. And we still need to engage those people and never give up on people. And we want to relentlessly engage those people because they're our brothers, our sisters, our uncles, our parents. And if they're healthy, then our community as a whole is healthy.
Vaughn Bryan is my guest. He's the executive director over at CP4P and the Metropolitan Peace Initiatives, which is part of Metropolitan Family Services. Also a former NFL player, played with the Detroit Lions and worked for the NFL as well. We'll take a quick break, come back, and talk more about what Vaughn's doing in the community. And also, as we said a little bit earlier, the NFL giving a big grant to you today. And congratulations on that. Vaughn Bryan, my guest here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. 720 WGN here with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Vaughn Bryan is here. He's the executive director for Communities Partnering for Peace. He is also, that's part of the Metropolitan Peace Initiatives at the Metropolitan Family Services. Got a big grant from the NFL today to work on a community police academy. What would we expect? Now, let's get specifically into this, because I kind of get an idea as a citizen of what a police academy is. I've seen the movies. But what is a community? I already asked you what it is, and we know on the sort of umbrella idea, but what are some of the specific things that you would sort of get into in a community police
guy? Yeah, so a couple of things would be just like icebreakers that help you get to know your people. So, you know, when you start, you know, a course or, you know, you start down a path together, you want to get to know the people around you and, you know, what their background is, what their values are, that sort of thing. So you know, fun games that allow you to really get to know each other on a human level. So, like, there's a, you know, an exercise we do in the mental health field called Think, Feel, Do. And you have a scenario that comes up and then you have to decide, you know, for yourself, based on your history, what do you do first? Do you act first? Do you think first? Do you feel first? And so it's, you know, sort of a fun way to think about different scenarios. And one of the reasons that would be relevant to the police is because the police are trained in a particular way. And whenever you do something on a regular basis, sometimes you get instincts. And so when your instincts are sharp, then you just do right away. You don't think or feel. And as an athlete, for example, they want you to get instincts. And that's why practice is so important, because you want to do things instinctually. You don't want to have to think about it. It has to be second nature.
Right,
and
right.
So, you know, those type of things, you know, matter. Or like if somebody says something to you, not understanding that that's a trigger, you may feel that first and then react in a negative way because those feelings are based on potentially some trauma you've experienced. And so, you know, it's just a fun way to think about how people behave, you know, and sort of getting to know each other. The other thing I would just want to add is that, you know, community tours are important. And so, you know, sometimes you police a community that you're not necessarily familiar with. So being able to tour the city, get some history of the city from the people who live there and understand the place, you know, I think is another thing that would be good. So
Vaughn Bryant's with me. He's the executive director over at the Communities Partners for Peace. You know, when you talk about a community police academy, a lot of the underlying, the reason why that has a ring to it, and the underlying feel is because there has been a rift between the police department and communities, in some specific communities. And that goes for everything from seeing the police as more militaristic or police seeing communities as not being cooperative, the no snitch kind of vibe that we hear all the time. When you're working with these kind of things and these things, and that's kind of going back to what I asked before, how do you debunk them? How do you kind of get the community and the police to get out of their comfort zones or get out of their stereotypes of what they think of the other because of what their neighbors said or what their other officers said? How do you peel that stuff back so it's raw and they get to know each other?
Yeah, so I think it's humanizing the other. I think we need to see our police as human, but the police need to see the citizens as, you know, people that are part of their beloved community. And once you build a relationship and you know people, then you're often going to be more accepting, give the benefit of the doubt. There's a deeper understanding because we just don't want the extremes. We don't want to have extreme reactions to what seems like minimal behavior. And we have to be able to trust our leadership and our institutions, and the police have a lot of weight in it that they carry and a huge responsibility. But that just comes with, you know, a higher burden of trust to be able to use the power that they have for good of the community. And the, you know, like it's so hard to accept that a traffic stop could end in death. That's just, wow. Like, I mean, really? Like, it's really tough. And so, you know, watching like Philando Castile, for example, like watching that video, like I actually hit a wall where it's like, I can't watch this stuff anymore, because having his daughter in the back seat and his girlfriend right next to him, and you know, the, you know, way that he tried to handle the situation, it's like, but the person who shot him clearly had some fear there, and so we can't have that.
That's a tough.
We cannot have that. Yeah.
And I think about that too, because there was a moment, like, I don't know if it was a boiling point, where those videos and those situations seem to happen every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the relationship, because of that awareness, because of that boiling point, has gotten better? Do you think that there are more training for police officers at traffic stops, that communities are getting better at recognizing the relationship with the police when you get to a traffic stop? Or is it just the way that the world works, that it's just been kind of quiet?
Yeah, it could be cyclical. I think, you know, sometimes when you reach sort of a tipping point, or you get to a sort of an extreme number, you know, statistically speaking, things are just going to drop off because they don't stay that high for a long time. So, you know, I'm always going to be slow to talk about, you know, any deliberate things that have, you know, changed the tide on that. I just think it's time will tell. And I'm more about finding the solutions that are going to make that trend you know, really go away to a point where, you know, it's not something that's a norm in our culture. Right. That's what I want to get to.
Vaughn Bryan is with me. He's the executive director over at CP4P in Chicago. Metropolitan Family Services has been a big part of communities. And we did a story, I think, in the summertime about the Fathers Program, the Young Fathers mm-hmm. Program there. You know, when you see more and more, and we did a lot of violence stories over the summer, that the police are just one part of it.
Mm-hmm.
That there needs to be more accountability when it comes to the community and the neighbors, but it also to the organizations. There's a lot going on that we can't just put it all on policing. Do you guys see it that way? Do you see it that's really where there's a void to fill, and it can't just be about police every time there's some sort of crime?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I think the police know that. They know that we can't arrest our way out of the violence in our communities. And, you know, there's a lot of factors involved. So poverty is involved. You know, there's a trauma to our communities that are involved. You know, there's, again, we talked about the systemic racism and discrimination and segregation. So all of those things have to be healed at its core. And so even the work we do is not necessarily getting to those core issues.
Yeah.
But what we have to do is stop the bleeding and start, you know, moving in a particular direction as we continue to work on those systemic things. So, yeah.
Yeah. I was you know, I was really educated this summer with a lot of those programs, because I realized that this is a much more complicated and complex problem than any news story can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we say the word gangs, and people think they know what that means, and it means something completely different on the street. Mm-hmm. You no longer have these organized gangs. Instead, it's as some of the counselors told us, it's cliques. It's mm-hmm. it's where you live. Mm-hmm. It's the block you live on. Mm-hmm. And it's really and obviously with the ability to get firearms at such an easy clip, legal firearms, there's really no way to be safe. How do you, when you practice and you preach and your organization's all about nonviolence and violence prevention, how do you get past that? How do you get through the idea that it is truly life or death on the streets for some of these kids? And yes, you can help them out, but that's still not going to help them when they're walking home from school.
Yeah, I think it's a culture change. Like, I think the work that our partners do, doing the outreach work, you know, one, they're credible messengers. They have a license to operate. They have some bravado in the communities that they're in. And our young folks need to see guys that come from what they come from doing something different. And so, you know, we have to, you know, again, the beloved community means that I don't look at you as a gang member. I look at you as part of my community. And no matter what, we need to be on the same side. And so it's no more us and them. And to the extent that we can increase that beloved community and give our young people less negative things to look forward to and show them that there's another way and love them, because a lot of the healing is going to come from a community loving our young people so that they, you know, have some trust and that they can heal from their trauma and move in a positive direction. But that takes more of a culture that's pulling them in that direction where there's less opportunities for, you know, falling through the cracks or going in a different direction. Well, and that's not to say that we're going to save every single person, but, you know, we clearly have a lot of work to do to do better than we are now.
I got to take a quick break. Can you stick around?
Yep.
Vaughn Bryant's here, executive director of CP4P and Metropolitan Peace Initiatives. They received a big grant from the NFL today, working on issues of nonviolence and violence prevention at Community Police Academy. We're talking about their work they do in specifically 22 vulnerable communities in Chicago, about trying to prevent violence on the streets of Chicago. Vaughn Bryan, a former NFL player and worked for the NFL. We'll talk a little bit about that too. We'll let it slide that it was the Detroit Lions, but we'll do it there. Vaughn Bryan with me here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Vaughn Bryant's here. He's the executive director for the Community Partners for Peace and Metropolitan Peace Initiatives. He's also a former NFL player, played with the Lions, also with the NFL. You went to Stanford. You mm-hmm. were you DB?
Corner. Yep.
Corner?
Mm-hmm.
What did that experience do for you? The idea that you went to college and played college football, went to the NFL, the discipline, all that kind of stuff that goes into being a professional athlete.
Yeah.
How does that stay with you years after you were on the field?
Yeah. So one thing I think is it gives you a thick skin. So when you get to that level of football, when you run out on the practice field, you're on film. Everything you do is on film. And after practice, you go watch the film and you critique everything you do. And so every practice and every game, you're being critiqued. And so I think the best thing that you can do to translate that into your real life is to be self-aware and to, you know, work on the things that you're not good at and to enhance the things that you keep your skills sharp on, the things that you are good at. But it helps you get to know who you are. And so I know what my strengths and weaknesses were as a player. And then it made it easy to understand who am I as a professional. Mm. And so, you know, getting into my professional life, you know, I know who I am. I know what my purpose is. I know what my gifts are. And I know how to use them for the purpose that I have on earth. And so I think it was a great training ground to gain some skills and some principles that I could apply to real life.
What do you say to kids, to teenagers, to young men who are growing up in communities when you say, I used to play ball? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you use it in the world that you work on now? Like,
I don't.
You don't?
I don't. I don't talk about it. I mean, one, it was a lifetime ago. And kids really only care about superstars, to be honest with you. You know, if I said I played for whoever,
then
you know,
they just want to race you down the street.
Yeah, like, they won't know me. You know, they know Deion Sanders and, you know, Barry Sanders and, you know, people like that. But, you know, I'm just some Joe Schmo.
So how do you do it? How do you I mean, because a lot of your job, of course, is to try and to set up this infrastructure and talk with young men about choosing a different path in their lives. What are the techniques and the tactics that you use when you get the opportunity to mediate or to be a part of their lives?
Yeah, so that wouldn't be me. That's not my role. So my role is, you know, more of an orchestrator role, but the outreach workers, they build a relationship. So I think they speak their language. They usually know the community that they come from. They are going to have some history that allows them to engage right away. So that's what you're finding commonalities in your, you know, just building a rapport. And, you know, just like you and I, like, we can kind of talk about where we're from and, you know, what brought you to Chicago. I'm not from Chicago. You know, and that's what you do. And over the course of time, you'd have influence because you've built a relationship. And I think one thing that's great about our outreach workers is they're committed to their work. They're committed to their communities. And a lot of the participants that work with them start to rely on them and gain trust in them because they see that they're loving them unconditionally, despite the things that they, you know, potentially could be involved in, and saying, hey, there's a different way. And we're going to, you know, stick with you even through some of your mistakes.
Yeah. Let's get to some of the text. 217 says, in a community police academy, would orientation by community members to police officers, would that be a mandatory part of police training? That's a good question, because right now there is a police academy. There is not a community police academy. But things are going to change because there's a consent decree about changing the way that police are trained.
Absolutely. So community police relations and building community trust is something that has to be a priority for CPD. You've heard the interim superintendent Beck talk about that. And we want to be a part of the solution. And we think that to the extent that police can, you know, give up a little bit of control and put some of the control in the hands of the community, that actually is going to go a long way in a shared, you know, model, because the police need the community to do their jobs, right? And honestly, we want police to feel safe in the communities, and to the extent that they're engaged in a relationship from day one and that they know who they can call on, you know, for different things, that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
One of the issues, and it's such a big issue, and again, I don't want to be in broad strokes or work in broad strokes here, but when we talk about the no snitch policy.
Yeah. Yep.
And we talk about protection, and I've had some great people in here talking about this, this idea that if you do step up and you talk about what happened in your community, at some point you have to go back into the community. Mm-hmm. The way the justice system is set up is at one point or another you have to face your accuser, and they have to go back in the community. And so many times over the years that has failed them when gangs and others have been able to go and find the person who ratted them out.
Yeah.
To the point where they're like, I am safer by not talking at all. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with years and years of that kind of relationship and undo that so community and police can work together?
You know, it's interesting. When I think about that question, I think about, you know, let's say the 1900s, when Al Capone was, you know, around. They didn't snitch back then either. And I wonder how if we were to answer the question with that lens on it,
sure.
How did the white community ultimately get rid of that? Partly because, in my mind, there's an off-ramp for them. There's an off-ramp into being a police officer, a fireman, getting a union job in a way that there's not for a lot of Black people and brown people. So they control the institution. So snitching doesn't become an issue because they're still a part of that same community. It's just more legitimized. And you don't see a lot of black and brown police officers. That's one of our biggest challenges. And I think when you have every community represented, then it makes it, you know, a different thing systemically, you know, where we don't have that right now because, like you said, it's failed us. And so it makes it difficult to make the argument there's going to be a positive outcome.
I was going to say, so you would say that to get rid of that stigma, to get rid of that distrust that is inherent from generation to generation, there needs to be an off-ramp.
Yeah.
There needs to be more opportunities for people to join the system as opposed to push against it.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's Vaughn Bryant's with me. He's the executive director over at CP4P. And we're talking about the grant you got from the NFL today to set up a community police academy, but also to work more on violence prevention and what you've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
This issue has become the issue of Chicago. It really has. I mean, it's a national story. Everybody talks about it. Like I said, you're getting less and less bad news, meaning you're getting better reports at the end of the year. I mean, still 500 people or just less than 500 people. But
still too much.
Still too much. So. Mm-hmm. Do you see those as wins, like little wins when you get when you see a news story that says no one was killed in Chicago today and it's the first day and it's in January? Are those wins to you?
Yeah, it's everything. Every day that people are safe is a win to me. I don't take life for granted. So I think it's important to take the daily wins, but continue to work towards, you know, getting our shooting rate down to where New York is. I mean, we want to be the safest city in the country. And in order to do that, we need years of investment. It took New York and LA 20 years to get to this point. We're at the very beginning stages. And so I think the community should be optimistic in a way that we haven't been in our recent history in terms of, you know, our governor is committed to this. Our mayor is committed to this. Our Cook County president is committed to this. And there's, you know, a level of investment now that is unprecedented. And I only see that increasing. But I think it's where the other side of that coin is it's up to our community based organizations to perfect their craft in their community. They have to be good stewards of this investment by really focusing in on doing their work in their neighborhoods, being relentless about engaging people and making sure that every person that I engage gets the services they need and that they are on to a trajectory that ultimately.
That's so well said.
Yeah.
It's well said because it was, I can't remember, it's maybe 10 years ago now that there was the violence prevention grants that came from the state of Illinois and Pat Quinn was the governor and that money was given to some organizations and then that money disappeared and it wasn't going to the actual, we weren't seeing anything. So there became a distrust from taxpayers and citizens to say, why are we continuing to give money to these organizations when they're as corrupt as the politicians that are giving them the money?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, honestly, that's what has brought Metropolitan Family Services to the table. It's a legacy nonprofit in Chicago. We were here for the Great Chicago Fire. And, you know, one of the things I think about as, you know, being a representative of Metropolitan is that, you know, we're involved for the biggest issues in Chicago. And so violence is the number one issue, and Metropolitan Family Services should be involved and lend our credibility, our hard work, and our expertise to the most important issues in Chicago.
One of the issues we haven't talked about, which came up with us this summer when we were out covering stories in Chicago, was trauma. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people are going to just specifically talk about the trauma of being shot or killed and what that means to the actual victims and the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
But communities surrounding that trauma, and that's to be families left behind, people who are witnesses, even the shooters themselves. Alex Kotlowitz wrote a great book about this and about this is the untreated scourge of Chicago that we're not talking about. And it is now generation to generation. It's affecting the way people live their lives and keeps them in this cycle. What do you do about that? From a violence prevention organization, when you're trying to do that, do you guys have to specifically think about it in a wider lens than just about the actual violence in the moment?
Yeah, so that's what it means to be trauma-informed. You have to do your work in a way that is informed, knowing that, you know, there's potential trauma that has been experienced, and I need to, you know, take the necessary steps not to trigger that trauma. So for, you know, an easy example is that, and this is more at the organizational level. So the history of our work is that, like, in June June 30th, when the fiscal year ends, you know, you're going through a contractual process to get, you know, state or government money to continue to do the work. historically, every year there's a gap in service because contracts aren't signed. That's not trauma-informed. If we know the summertime is the heaviest time for violence, why would we go through some administrative process that disrupts the violence prevention work during the heaviest time? So even from a governmental perspective, let's create systems and processes that is trauma-informed, not to re-traumatize vulnerable people who have doing their first job trying to be in a community, getting laid off, which then is re-traumatizing them, and then maybe they get a job a couple of months later. Why would I stay with that job of trying to make my community better when there's disruption? Like, you and I, we're not doing a job where somebody's going to tell me on January 1st or December 25th, hey, we're not going to be able to renew you for a couple of weeks, sit tight, and then we'll get back to you. No, that re-traumatizes people. And so, but the multiplier effect of that is the organizations become traumatized because they are the ones people, that are, they're well, the ones yeah, in right, between right, because right. I got to go lay you off. And so when I'm talking to the state, I'm pissed at the and I'm traumatized.
So that's what's happening. So this is things I think a lot of, I know me and I know the people that are listening and others aren't familiar with that kind of concept. Yeah. The idea that the state gets to a certain point and they don't have enough money or they run out or they're just making a transition and they got to lay people off.
Yeah. So, right. So it's really more about like there's systems and processes that the state has to follow. Like there's, you know, we wouldn't deny that. So like when we started taking over some state money in fiscal year 20, and we fought hard to say, hey, we don't want to go through an RFP process in the spring because we don't want to have to sign, go through a contractual system during the time when it's worse. So they gave us a 6-month leave where we're just going to renew and do what we've been doing through the summer, start the RFP process after that. And then we can, you know, wait to the wintertime when the violence is.
Right.
But the either way, still, the point is that you also have to have policies to say, if I've been doing the work for 6 months and we have to, you know, redo our contracts, if we've already know what the money is and we have a history, make sure you pay them starting January 1st. Yeah, even if it takes us a long time to get through if we sign a contract January 15th, still pay them January 1st because they're already doing the work. Don't force me to lay people off for 2 weeks. It's those sort of things, which are not, you know, that's part of the reason, like, the private sector is like, we don't want regulation because of that kind of stuff.
Right.
And we need that same thing in our communities
So here's my last question for you. Just as you mentioned that we have a Cook County Board president, a mayor, a governor who have all said that the number one priority in the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago is violence.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen the NFL step up here as we're talking with Von Bryant right here, right now, because the NFL gave you guys a grant. With these resources that are coming in and people have decided this is the investment, this is the number one priority, should we as citizens in the state of Illinois who may not be affected by violence, should we expect to see returns? Should we expect to see better numbers? Should we expect to see the violence problem being taken care of?
Absolutely. Anytime you make an investment, you should expect a return, period. And so it's my job, it's our job as a coalition, again, to be good stewards of the resources we get. If we are successful, that means we're going to get more resources. And honestly, too, if we're successful, then the work will evolve. 15 years from now, I don't expect to be doing the exact same thing. I still expect some investment, but the investment and what we do should evolve with our success and that things change. Like, let me give you one example. When I built Safe Passage for Chicago Public Schools, it was during a time where you would hear about a CPS student getting shot on a regular basis. We would say we don't hear about that anymore. But here's when I talk about evolution. When we started at 30 plus of the most violent high schools. We said we're just going to do high schools. And, you know, let's say a school like Gage Park, there were 40 Safe Passage workers out there because it's a huge school and the way the neighborhood is configured, we needed a lot of people to make sure, you know, kids were safe. Today, schools may have, you know, probably no more than 10, and there are far more schools that get it because it evolved over time. We didn't need as many people because the violence changed, and you could actually serve more schools with the same amount of money, but, you know, keep more schools happy. And so that's a point where we've evolved, And that's a good thing, right? So well, don't just keep doing the same
thing. Yeah, just listening to you talk about safe passages and talk about your work with CP4P, you got to come back. I'd love to talk more about, because we haven't even gotten into education and the school systems and what safe passages actually really means when it comes to violence and schools. When you're talking about bullets flying outside of schools, the kids coming, that's everybody's mind gets blown on that kind of thing. So Vaughn Bryant, Executive Director of the Community Partners for Peace and the Metropolitan Peace Initiatives, they have plans for a community police academy. They got a grant from the NFL. Vaughn used to work, play in the NFL, worked for the NFL, and he now is the Executive Director for the Communities Partnering for Peace. Vaughn, thanks for being here. Thanks for being my guest, and I can't wait to have you back.
Thanks for having me.